about Strike and Charlotte's relationship. Isla had told us Strike had refused an invitation to go over to their house that evening for dinner, claiming that he had a prior arrangement with his sister. Robin found it hard to believe this, given Strike's and Lucy's recent row. Perhaps she was being paranoid. But she'd also wondered whether Strike wasn't avoiding being in her company outside work hours. "You don't suspect Irene, do you?"
"Only of being a liar, a gossip and a compulsive attention seeker," said Strike. "I don't think she's bright enough to have abducted Margot Bamborough and not given herself away in 40 years. On the other hand, lies are always interesting. Anything else catch your interest?"
"Yes. There was something funny about that Leamington spa story, or rather, Irene's reaction when she heard Janice talking about it. I think Leamington spa meant something to her, and it was odd that Janice hadn't told her what the patient said. You'd think she definitely would have done, given that they're best friends, and they both knew Margot, and they've stayed in touch all these years. Even if Janice thought that man Ramage was making it all up, why wouldn't she tell Irene?"
"Another good point," said Strike, looking thoughtfully at the neoclassical facade of the National Maritime Museum as they drove past wide stretches of beautifully manicured emerald lawn. "What did you think of Janice?"
"Well, when we were allowed to hear her speak, she seemed quite decent," said Robin cautiously. "She seemed fair-minded about Margot and Douthwaite. Why she puts up with being treated as Irene Skivvy, though.
Some people need to be needed, and there might be a sense of obligation if Irene was telling the truth about her and her husband helping Janice out financially when she needed it."
Strike spotted the pub Robin had chosen from a distance, large and opulent-looking, with many balconies and awnings, not to mention window baskets and coats of arms. It stood on the bank of the Thames. Robin parked and they proceeded past black iron bollards to the paved area where many wooden tables afforded a view over the river, in the midst of which a life-size black statue of the diminutive Lord Nelson faced the water. "See," said Robin, "you can sit outside and smoke."
"Isn't it a bit cold?" said Strike.
"This coat's padded. I'll get the—"
"No, I will," said Strike firmly. "What do you want?"
"Just a lime and soda, please, as I'm driving." As Strike walked into the pub, there was a sudden chorus of "Happy Birthday to You." For a split second, seeing helium balloons in the corner, he was horror-struck, thinking that Robin had brought him here for a surprise party. But a bare heartbeat later, it registered that he didn't recognize a single face, and that the balloons formed the figure 80. A tiny woman with lavender hair was beaming at the top of a table full of family. Flashes went off as she blew out the candles on a large chocolate cake. Applause and cheers followed, and a toddler blew a feathered whistle. Strike headed towards the bar, still slightly shaken, taking himself to task for having imagined, for a moment, that Robin would have arranged a surprise party for him. Even Charlotte, with whom he'd had the longest and closest relationship of his life, had never done that. Indeed, Charlotte had never allowed anything as mundane as his birthday to interfere with her own whims and moods. On Strike's 27th, when she'd been going through one of her intermittent phases of either rampant jealousy or rage at his refusal to give up the army, the precise causes of their many scenes and rows tended to blur in his mind, she'd thrown his wrapped gif out of a third-floor window in front of him. But of course, there were other memories. His 33rd birthday, for instance. He'd just been discharged from Selly Oak Hospital and was walking for the first time on a prosthesis, and Charlotte had taken him back to her flat in Notting Hill, cooked for him, and returned from the kitchen at the end of the meal, holding 2 cups of coffee, stark naked, and more beautiful than any woman he had ever seen. He'd laughed and gasped at the same time. He hadn't had sex for nearly 2 years. The night that followed would probably never be forgotten by him, nor the way she had sobbed in his arms afterwards, telling him that he was the only man for her, that she was afraid of what she felt, afraid that she was evil for not regretting his missing lower leg if it brought her back to him, if it meant that, at last, she could look after him as he had always looked after her. And close to midnight, Strike had proposed to her, and they'd made love again, and then talked through to dawn about how he was going to start his detective agency, and she'd told him she didn't want a ring, that he was to save his money for his new career, at which he would be magnificent. Drinks and crisps purchased, Strike returned to Robin, who was sitting on an outside bench, hands in her pockets, looking glum.
"Cheer up," said Strike, speaking to himself as much as to her.
"Sorry," said Robin, though she didn't really know why she was apologizing. He sat down beside her, rather than opposite, so both of them faced the river. There was a small shingle beach below them, and waves lapped the cold pebbles. On the opposite bank rose the steel-coloured office blocks of Canary Wharf, to their left, the Shard. The river was the colour of lead on this cold November day. Strike tore one of the crisp packets down the middle, so that both could help themselves. Wishing she'd asked for a coffee instead of a cold drink, Robin took a sip of her lime and soda, ate a couple of crisps, returned her hands to her pockets, then said,
"I know this isn't the attitude, but honestly, I don't think we're going to find out what happened to Margot Bamborough."
"What's brought this on?"
"I suppose Irene misremembering names. Janice going along with her, covering up the reason for the Christmas party row. It's such a long time ago. People are under no obligation to tell the truth to us now, even if they can remember it. Factor in people getting wedded to old theories, like that whole thing about Gloria and the pill in Brenner's mug, and people wanting to make themselves important, pretending to know things, and... well, I'm starting to think we're attempting the impossible here."
A wave of tiredness had swept over Robin while sitting in the cold, waiting for Strike, and in its wake had come hopelessness.
"Pull yourself together," said Strike, bracingly. "We've already found out two big things the police never knew."
He pulled out his cigarettes, lit one, then said, "Firstly, there was a big stock of barbiturates on the premises where Margot worked. Secondly, Margot Bamborough might well have had an abortion." "Taking the barbiturates first," he said, "are we overlooking something very obvious, which is that there were means on the premises to put someone to sleep?"
"Margot wasn't put to sleep," said Robin, gloomily munching crisps. "She walked out of there."
"Only if we assume Gloria wasn't lying, I know," said Robin.
"But how does she and Theo, because Theo's still got to be in on it, hasn't she? How did Gloria and Theo administer enough barbiturates to render Margot unconscious? Don't forget, if Irene's telling the truth, Margot wasn't letting anyone else make her drinks at that point. And from what Janice said about dosage, you'd need a lot of pills to make someone actually unconscious."
"Well reasoned. So, going back to that little story about the pill in the tea, didn't you believe it?"
"I did," said Strike, "because it seems a totally pointless lie. It's not interesting enough to make an exciting anecdote, is it? Single pill. It does reopen the question of whether Margot knew about or suspected Brenner's addiction, though. She might have noticed him being odd in his manner. Downers would make him drowsy. Perhaps she'd seen he was slow on the uptake. Everything we've found out about Margot suggests that if she thought Brenner was behaving unprofessionally, or might be dangerous to patients, she'd have waded straight in and confronted him. And we've just heard a lot of interesting background on Brenner, who sounds like a traumatized, unhappy and lonely man. What if Margot threatened him with being struck off? Loss of status and prestige to a man who has virtually nothing else in his life. People have killed for less.
He left the surgery before she did that night.
What if he waited for her? Offered her a lift?
If he did, I think she'd have been suspicious, said Robin.
Not that he wanted to hurt her, but that he was going to shout at her, which would have been in character from what we know of him. I'd rather have walked in the rain, personally. And she was a lot younger than him, and tall and fit. I can't remember now where he lived.
With his unmarried sister about 20 minutes' drive from the practice. The sister said he'd arrived home at the usual time. A dog-walking neighbour confirmed they'd seen him through the window round about 11. But I can think of one other possibility regarding those barbiturates, Strike went on. As Janice pointed out, they had street value, and by the sounds of it, Brenner had amassed a big stock of them. We've got to consider the possibility that some outsider knew there were valuable drugs on the premises, set out to nick them, and Margot got in the way. Which takes us back to Margot dying on the premises, which means Gloria and Theo come back into the frame. Gloria and Theo might have planned to take the drugs themselves. And we've just heard about the drug-dealing brother, said Robin. Why the sceptical tone?
Irene was determined to have a go at Gloria, wasn't she?
She was, yeah. But the fact that Gloria had a drug-dealing brother is information worth knowing, as is the fact that there were a stack of drugs on the premises that were ripe for nicking. Brenner wouldn't have wanted to admit he had them in the first place, so probably wouldn't have reported the theft, which makes for a situation open to exploitation.
A criminal brother doesn't make a person criminal in themselves.
Agreed. But it makes me even keener to find Gloria. The term person of interest fits her pretty accurately. And then there's the abortion, said Strike. If Irene's telling the truth about the nursing home calling to confirm the appointment.
If, said Robin.
I don't think that was a lie, said Strike. For the opposite reason to the pill in Brenner's cup. That lie's too big. People don't make things like that up. Anyway, she told Janice about it at the time, and their little row about patient confidentiality rings true. And C.B. Oakden must have based the story on something. I wouldn't be at all surprised if that tip-off came from Irene. She doesn't strike me as a woman who turned down a chance to speculate or gossip.
Robin said nothing. She'd only once in her life had to face the possibility that she might be pregnant, and could still remember the relief that had flooded her when it became clear that she wasn't, and wouldn't have to face still more contact with strangers and another intimate procedure, more blood, more pain. Imagine aborting your husband's child, she thought. Could Margot really have done that, when she already had that child's sister at home? What had been going through her mind a month before she disappeared? Perhaps she'd been quietly breaking down, like Talbot. The past few years had taught Robin how very mysterious human beings were, even to those who thought they knew them best. Infidelity and bigamy, kinks and fetishes, theft and fraud, stalking and harassment. She'd now delved into so many secret lives she'd lost count. Nor did she hold herself superior to any of the deceived and duped who came to the agency, craving truth. Hadn't she thought she knew her own husband back to front? How many hundreds of nights had they lain entwined like Siamese twins, whispering confidences and sharing laughter in the dark? She'd spent nearly half her life with Matthew, and not until a hard, bright diamond ear stud had appeared in their bed had she realized that he was living a life apart, and was not, and perhaps never had been, the man she thought she knew.
You don't want to think she had an abortion, said Strike, correctly deducing at least part of the reason for Robin's silence.
She didn't answer, instead asking, You haven't heard back from her friend Una, have you?
Didn't I tell you? Said Strike. Yeah, I got an email yesterday. She is a retired vicar, and she'd be delighted to meet us when she comes down to London to do some Christmas shopping. Date to be confirmed.
That's good, said Robin. You know, I'd like to talk to someone who actually liked Margot.
Gupta liked her, said Strike. And Janice, she's just said so.
Robin ripped open the second bag of crisps. Which is what you'd expect, isn't it? She said. That people would at least pretend they liked Margot, after what happened. But Irene didn't. Don't you find it a bit excessive to be holding on to that much resentment 40 years later? She really put the boot in. Wouldn't you think it was, I don't know, more politic?
To claim to be friends?
Yes. But maybe Irene knew there were far too many witnesses to the fact that they weren't friends. What did you think of the anonymous note? True or false?
Good question, said Strike, scratching his chin. Irene really enjoyed telling us Margot had been called the C-word, but hellfire doesn't sound like the kind of thing she'd invent. I'd have expected something more in the uppity bitch line.
He drew out his notebook again, and scanned the notes he'd made of the interview.
Well, we still need to check these leads out for what they're worth. Why don't you follow up Charlie Ramage and Leamington Spar, and I'll look into the Benny abusing Applethorpe?
You just did it again, said Robin.
Did what?
Smirked when you said Benny's. What's so funny about Benzedrine?
Oh, Strike chuckled. I was just reminded of something my Uncle Ted told me. Did you ever watch Crossroads?
What's Crossroads?
I always forget how much younger you are, Strike said. It was a daytime soap opera, and it had a character in it called Benny. He was, well, these days you'd call him special needs. Simple. He wore a woolly hat. Iconic character in his way.
You were thinking of him, said Robin. It didn't seem particularly amusing.
No, but you need to know about him to understand the next bit. I assume you know about the Falklands War.
I'm younger than you, Strike. I'm not pig ignorant.
Okay, right. So, the British troops who went over there, Ted was there in 1982, nicknamed the locals Bennies after the character on Crossroads. Command gets wind of this, and the order comes down the line, stop calling these people we've just liberated Bennies. So, said Strike, grinning, they started calling them Stills.
Stills? What does Stills mean?
Still Bennies, said Strike, and he let out a great roar of laughter.
Robin laughed too, but mostly at Strike's amusement. When his guffaws had subsided, both watched the river for a few seconds, drinking, and in Strike's case, smoking, until he said,
I'm going to write to the Ministry of Justice, apply for permission to visit Creed.
Seriously?
We've got to try. The authorities always thought Creed assaulted or killed more women than he was done for. There was jewellery in his house and bits of clothing nobody ever identified. Just because everyone thinks it's Creed doesn't mean it isn't, agreed Robin, who followed the tortured logic perfectly.
Strike sighed, rubbed his face, cigarette still poking out of his mouth, then said,
Want to see exactly how crazy Talbot was?
Go on. Strike pulled the leather-bound notebook out of the inside pocket of his coat and handed it to her. Robin opened it and turned the pages in silence. They were covered in strange drawings and diagrams. The writing was small, meticulously neat but cramped. There was much underlining and circling of phrases and symbols. The pentagram recurred. The pages were littered with names, but none connected with the case. Crowley, Levi, Adams, and Schmidt. Huh, she said quietly, stopping on a particularly heavy embellished page on which a goat's head with a third eye looked balefully up at her.
Look at this.
She bent closer.
He's using astrological symbols.
He's what? Said Strike, frowning down at the page she was perusing.
That's Libra, said Robin, pointing at a symbol towards the bottom of the page. It's my sign. I used to have a key ring with that on it.
He's using bloody star signs, said Strike, pulling the book back towards him, looking so disgusted that Robin started to laugh again.
Strike scanned the page. Robin was right. The circles drawn around the goat's head told him something else, too.
He's calculated the full horoscope for the moment he thought she was abducted, he said. Look at the date there. The 11th of October, 1974. 6:30 in the evening. Fuck's sake. Astrology. He was out of his tree.
What's your sign? Said Robin, trying to work it out.
No idea. Oh, sod off, said Robin.
He looked at her, taken aback. You're being affected, she said. Everyone knows their star sign. Don't pretend to be above it. Strike grinned reluctantly, took a large drag on his cigarette, exhaled, then said,
Sagittarius, Scorpio rising, with the sun in the first house.
You're... Robin began to laugh. Did you just pull that out of your backside, or is it real?
Of course it's not fucking real, said Strike. None of it's real, is it? But yeah, that's what my natal horoscope says. Stop bloody laughing. Remember who my mother was? She loved all that shit. One of her best mates did my full horoscope for her when I was born. I should have recognised that straight off, he said, pointing at the goat drawing. But I haven't been through this properly yet. Haven't had time.
So, what does having the sun in the first house mean?
It means nothing. It's all bollocks.
Robin could tell that he didn't want to admit that he'd remembered, which made her laugh some more. Half annoyed, half amused, he muttered,
"Independent. Leadership.
Well,
it's all bollocks. And we've got enough mystic crap swimming round this case without adding star signs. The medium and the holy place. Talbot and Baphomet.
Irene and her broken Margot Fontaine," said Robin.
"Irene and her broken fucking Margot Fontaine," Strike muttered, rolling his eyes.
A fine shower of icy rain began to fall, speckling the tabletop and over Talbot's notebook, which Strike closed before the ink could run. In unspoken agreement, both got up and headed back towards the Land Rover. The lavender-haired old lady, who shared Strike's birthday, was now being helped into a nearby Toyota by what looked like two daughters. All around her car stood family, smiling and talking under umbrellas. Just for a moment, as he pulled himself back inside the Land Rover, Strike wondered where he'd be if he lived to 80, and who'd be there with him.
Chapter 22. And later times things more unknown shall show. Why then should witless man so much misween that nothing is but that which he hath seen? What if within the moon's fair shining sphere, what if in every other star unseen, of other worlds he happily should hear? Edmund Spenser, The Faerie Queen.
Strike got himself a takeaway that night, to eat alone in his attic flat. As he upended the Singapore noodles onto his plate, he inwardly acknowledged the irony that, had Isla not been so keen to act as midwife to a romantic relationship between himself and Robin, he might now have been sitting in Nick and Isla's flat in Octavia Road, enjoying a laugh with two of his old friends, and indeed with Robin herself, whose company had never yet palled on him, through the many long hours they had worked together. Strike's thoughts lingered on his partner while he ate, on the kiss on the well-chosen card, on the headphones, and the fact that she was now calling him Strike in moments of annoyance, or when the two of them were joking, all of them clear signs of increasing intimacy. However stressful the divorce proceedings, of which she'd shared few details, however little she might consciously be seeking romance, she was, nevertheless, a free agent. Not for the first time, Strike wondered exactly how egotistical it was to suspect that Robin's feelings towards him might be warmer than those of pure friendship. He got on with her better than he'd ever got on with any woman. Their mutual liking had survived all the stresses of running a business together, the personal trials each had endured since they had met, even the major disagreement that had once seen him sack her. She'd hurried to the hospital when he had found himself alone with a critically ill nephew, brooking, he had no doubt, the displeasure of the ex-husband Strike never forgot to call "that arsehole" inside his own head. Nor was Strike unconscious of Robin's good looks. Indeed, he'd been fully aware of them ever since she'd taken off her coat in his office for the first time. But her physical appeal was less of a threat to his peace of mind than the deep, guilty liking for being, currently, the main man in her life. Now that the possibility of something more lay in front of him, now that her husband was gone and she was single, he found himself seriously wondering what would happen should they act upon what he was beginning to suspect was a mutual attraction. Could the agency, for which they'd both sacrificed so much, which for Strike represented the culmination of all his ambitions, survive the partners falling into bed together? However he reframed this question, the answer always came back, no, because he was certain, for reasons that had to do with past trauma, not from any particularly puritanical streak, that what Robin sought, ultimately, was the security and permanence of marriage. And he wasn't the marrying kind. No matter the inconveniences, what he craved at the end of a working day was his private space, clean and ordered, organized exactly as he liked it, free of emotional storms, from guilt and recriminations, from demands to service Hallmark's idea of romance, from a life where someone else's happiness was his responsibility. The truth was that he'd always been responsible for some woman. For Lucy, as they grew up together in squalor and chaos. For Leda, who lurched from lover to lover, and whom he had sometimes had to physically protect as a teenager. For Charlotte, whose volatility and self-destructive tendencies had been given many different names by therapists and psychiatrists, but whom he had loved in spite of it all. He was alone now, and at a kind of peace. None of the affairs or one-night stands that he'd had since Charlotte had touched the essential part of him. He'd sometimes wondered since whether Charlotte had not stunted his ability to feel deeply. Except that, almost against his will, he did care about Robin. He felt familiar stirrings of a desire to make her happy that irked him far more than the habit he'd developed of looking determinedly away when she bent over a desk. They were friends, and he hoped they'd always be friends. And he suspected the best way to guarantee that was never to see each other naked. When he'd washed up his plate, Strike opened the window to admit the cold night air, reminding himself that every woman he knew would have been complaining immediately about the draught. He then lit a cigarette, opened the laptop he'd brought upstairs, and drafted a letter to the Ministry of Justice, explaining that he'd been hired by Anna Phipps, setting out his proven credentials as an investigator, both within the army and outside it, and requesting permission to visit and question Dennis Creed in Broadmoor. Once finished, he yawned, lit his umpteenth cigarette of the day, and went to lie down on his bed, as usual, undoing his trousers first. Picking up The Demon of Paradise Park, he turned to the final chapter. The question that haunts the officers who entered Creed's basement in 1976 and saw for themselves the combination of jail and torture chamber that he'd constructed there is whether the 12 women he is known to have assaulted, raped, and or killed represent the total tally of his victims. In our final interview, Creed, who that morning had been deprived of privileges following an aggressive outburst against a prison officer, was at his least communicative and most cryptic. Question. People suspect there may have been more victims. Answer. Is that right? Louise Tucker. She was 16. She'd run away. You journalists love putting ages on people, don't you? Why is that? Because it paints a picture. It's a detail we can all identify with. Do you know anything about Louise Tucker? Yeah, she was 16. There was unclaimed jewellery in your basement, unclaimed pieces of clothing. Silence. You don't want to talk about the unclaimed jewellery? Silence. Why don't you want to talk about those unclaimed items? Silence. Does any part of you think, I've got nothing to lose now? I could put people's minds at rest, stop families wondering. Silence. You don't think it would be a kind of reparation? I could repair something of my reputation. Laughs. Reputation? You think I spend my days worrying about my reputation? You people really don't. Indistinguishable. What about Kara Wolfson? Disappeared in 73. How old was she? 26. Club hostess in Soho. I don't like whores. Why's that? Filthy. You frequented prostitutes. When there was nothing else on offer. You tried. Helen Wardrop was a prostitute, and she got away from you. Gave a description to the police. Silence. You tried to abduct Helen in the same area Kara was last seen. Silence. What about Margot Bamborough? Silence. A van resembling your van was seen speeding in the area she disappeared. Silence. If you abducted Bamborough, she'd have been in your basement at the same time as Susan Mayer, wouldn't she? Nice for her. Was it nice for her? Someone to talk to. Are you saying you were holding both Bamborough and Mayer at the same time? Smiles. What about Andrea Hooton? Was Bamborough dead when you abducted Andrea? Silence. You threw Andrea's body off cliffs. That was a change in your M.O. Was she the first body you threw off there? Silence. You don't want to confirm whether you abducted Margot Bamborough. Smiles. Strike put down the book and lay for a while, smoking and thinking. Then he reached for Bill Talbot's leather-bound notebook, which he'd earlier thrown onto his bed when taking off his coat. Flicking through the densely packed pages,
looking for something comprehensible, something he could connect with, a solid fact or reference point. He suddenly placed a thick finger in the book to stop the pages turning, his attention caught by a sentence written mostly in English that seemed familiar. 12th, symbol, found. Therefore, as expected, killer is symbol. It was an effort to get up and fetch his own notebook, but this he did. Slumping back onto his bed, he found the sentence that Pat had translated for him from Pitman's shorthand. And that is the last of them, the 12th, and the circle will be closed upon finding the 10th, unknown word, Baphomet. Transcribe in the true book. The unknown word, Strike realized, was the same symbol that followed the word killer in Talbot's notebook. With a feeling of both exasperation and curiosity, Strike picked up his phone and googled astrological symbols. A few minutes later, having read a couple of astrological web pages with an expression of mild distaste, he'd successfully interpreted Talbot's sentence. It read, 12th, brackets, Pisces, found. Therefore, as expected, killer is Capricorn. Pisces was the 12th sign of the zodiac, Capricorn the 10th. Capricorn was also the sign of the goat, which Talbot, in his manic state, appeared to have connected with Baphomet, the goat-headed deity. "Fuck's sake," muttered Strike, turning to a fresh page in his notebook and writing something. An idea now occurred to him. Those strange, unexplained dates with crosses beside them and all the male witnesses' statements. He wondered whether he could be bothered to get up and go downstairs to fetch the relevant pages from the boxes of police records. With a sigh, he decided that the answer was yes. He did up his flies, heaved himself to his feet, and fetched the office keys from their hook by the door. 10 minutes later, Strike returned to his bedroom with both his laptop and a fresh notebook. As he settled down on top of the duvet again, he noticed that the screen of his mobile, which was lying on the duvet, was now lit up. Somebody had tried to call him while he'd been downstairs. Expecting it to be Lucy, he picked up the phone and looked at it. He'd just missed a call from Charlotte. Strike laid the phone back down again and opened his laptop. Slowly and painstakingly, he set to work matching the unexplained dates on each male suspect's witness statements with the relevant sign of the zodiac. If his hunch that Talbot had been checking the men's star signs was correct, Stephen Douthwaite was a Pisces, Paul Satchwell was an Aries, and Roy Phipps, who'd been born on the 27th of December, was a Capricorn. Yet Talbot had cleared Roy Phipps of involvement early in the case.
"So that makes no fucking sense," muttered Strike to the empty room.
He put down his laptop and picked up Talbot's notebook again, reading on from the assertion that Margot's killer must be Capricorn.
"Christ almighty," Strike muttered,
trying, but not entirely succeeding, to find sense among the mass of esoteric ramblings with the aid of his astrological websites. As far as he could tell, Talbot appeared to have absolved Roy Phipps from suspicion on the grounds that he wasn't really a Capricorn, but some sign that Strike couldn't make head nor tail of, and which he suspected Talbot might have invented. Returning to the notebook, Strike recognized the Celtic cross layout of tarot cards from his youth. Leda fancied herself a reader of tarot. Many times had he seen her lay out the cards in the very formation Talbot had sketched in the middle of the page. He had never, however, seen the cards given astrological meanings before, and wondered whether this, too, had been Talbot's own invention. His mobile buzzed again. He picked it up. Charlotte had sent him a photograph. A naked photograph of herself holding two coffees. The accompanying message said, 6 years ago tonight. I wish it was happening again. Happy birthday, Bluey. Kiss. Against his will, Strike stared at the body no sentient heterosexual man could fail to desire, and at the face Venus would envy. Then he noticed the blurring along her lower stomach, where she'd airbrushed out her caesarean scar. This took care of his burgeoning erection.
Like an alcoholic pushing away brandy, he deleted the picture and returned to Talbot's notebook. Chapter 23. It is the mind that maketh good or ill, that maketh wretch or happy, rich or poor. For some, that hath abundance at his will, hath not enough, but wants in greatest store. And other, that hath little, asks no more, but in that little is both rich and wise. Edmund Spenser, The Faerie Queen. 11 days later, Robin was woken at 8 a.m. by her mobile ringing, after barely an hour's sleep. She'd spent the night on another pointless vigil outside the house of the persecuted weatherman, and had returned to her flat in Earl's Court to grab a couple of hours' sleep before hurrying out again to interview Una Kennedy with Strike in the cafe at Fortnum and Mason. Completely disorientated, she knocked a couple of items off the bedside table as she groped in the dark for her phone.
"Hello?" "Robin!" said a happy shout in her ear. "You're an aunt!"
"What, sorry?" she muttered.
Wisps of her dreams still clung about her. Pat Chauncey had been asking her out to dinner, and had been deeply hurt that she didn't want to go.
"You're an aunt! Jenny's just had the baby!"
"Oh,"
said Robin, and very slowly her brain computed that this was Stephen, her elder brother, on the line.
"Oh, that's wonderful. What,
a girl?" said Stephen jubilantly. "Annabel Marie, £8.8.
"Wow," said Robin. "That's... is that big?"
"It seems." "I'm sending you a picture now," said Stephen. "Got it?"
"No, hang on," said Robin, sitting up.
Bleary-eyed, she switched a speakerphone to check her messages. The picture arrived as she was peering at the screen, a wrinkled, bald red baby, swaddled in a hospital robe, fists balled up, looking furious to have been forced from a place of quiet, padded darkness into the brightness of a hospital ward.
"Just got it." "Oh, Stephen, she's beautiful."
It was a lie, but nevertheless, tears prickled in the exhausted Robin's eyes.
"My God, Button," she said quietly.
It was Stephen's childhood nickname.
"You're a dad."
"I know," he said. "Insane, isn't it? When are you coming home to see her?" "Soon," Robin promised.
"I'm back for Christmas. Give Jenny all my love, won't you?"
"I will, yeah. Gonna call John now. See you soon, Robs." The call was cut. Robin lay in the darkness, staring at the brightly lit picture of the crumpled baby, whose puffy eyes were screwed up against a world she seemed to have decided already was not much of a place. It was quite extraordinary to think of her brother Stephen as a father, and that the family now had one more member. Robin seemed to hear her cousin Katie's words again.
"It's like you're travelling in a different direction to the rest of us."
In the old days with Matthew, before she'd started work at the agency, she'd expected to have children with him. Robin had no strong feelings against having children. It was simply that she knew now that the job she loved would be impossible if she were a mother, or at least that it would stop being the job she loved. Motherhood, from her limited observation of those her age who were doing it, seemed to demand as much from a woman as she could possibly give. Katie had talked of the perennial tug on her heart when she wasn't with her son, and Robin had tried to imagine an emotional tether even stronger than the guilt and anger with which Matthew had tried to retain her. The problem wasn't that Robin didn't think she'd love her child. On the contrary, she thought it likely that she would love that child to the extent that this job, for which she had voluntarily sacrificed a marriage, her safety, her sleep, and her financial security, would have to be sacrificed in return. And how would she feel afterwards about the person who'd made that sacrifice necessary? Robin turned on the light and bent to pick up the thing she had knocked off her bedside table. An empty glass, thankfully unbroken, and the thin, flimsy paperback entitled "Whatever Happened to Margot Bamborough" by C.B. Oakden, which Robin had received in the post the previous morning and which she'd already read. Strike didn't yet know that she had managed to get hold of a copy of Oakden's book, and Robin had been looking forward to showing him. She had a couple more fragments of Bamborough news too, but now, Perhaps because of her sheer exhaustion, the feeling of anticipation at sharing them had disappeared. Deciding that she wouldn't be able to get back to sleep, she got out of bed. As she showered, Robin realized, to her surprise, that she was crying.
"This is ridiculous. You don't even want a baby. Get a grip of yourself."
When Robin arrived upstairs, dressed, with her hair blow-dried and concealer applied to the shadows under her eyes, she found Max eating toast in the kitchen.
"Morning,"
he said, looking up from a perusal of the day's news on his phone. "You all right?"
"Fine,"
said Robin, with forced brightness. "Just found out I'm an aunt. My brother Stephen's wife gave birth this morning."
"Oh, congratulations,"
said Max, politely interested.
Boy or girl?"
"Girl,"
said Robin, turning on the coffee machine.
"I've got about 8 godchildren," said Max gloomily.
"Parents love giving the job to childless people. They think we'll put more effort in, having no kids of our own."
"True,"
said Robin, trying to maintain her cheery tone. She'd been made godmother to Katie's son. The christening had been the first time she'd been in a church in Masham since her wedding to Matthew. She took a mug of black coffee back to her bedroom, where she opened up her laptop and decided to set down her new information on the Bamborough case in an email to Strike before they met. They might not have much time together before Una Kennedy's interview, so this would expedite discussion.
"Hi. Few bits and pieces on Bamborough before I see you. Charles Ramage, the hot-tub millionaire, is dead. I've spoken to his son, who couldn't confirm the story about the Margot sighting, but remembered Janice nursing his father after his crash, and said Ramage Sr. liked her and probably told her all his stories. He had loads of them. Said his father never minded exaggerating if it made a story better, but was not a liar and had a good heart. Wouldn't have told a lie about a missing woman. Also confirmed that his father was close friends with a senior police officer, couldn't remember rank or first name, called Green. Ramage Sr.'s widow is still alive and living in Spain, but she's his second wife and the son doesn't get on with her. I'm trying to get a contact number, email address for her. I'm 99% sure I've found the right Amanda White, who's now called Amanda Laws. 2 years ago, she posted a piece on Facebook about people disappearing, which included Margot. She said in the comment that she'd been personally involved in the Margot disappearance. I've sent her a message, but nothing back yet. I've got hold of a copy of Whatever Happened to Margot Bamborough, and read it. It's not long. Judging by what we know about Margot so far, it looks full of inaccuracies. I'll bring it with me this morning. See you in a bit. Kiss."
Sleep-deprived, Robin had added the kiss automatically and had sent the email before she could retract it. It was one thing to put a kiss on a birthday card, quite another to start adding them to work emails.
Shit.
She could hardly write a PS saying, "Ignore that kiss, my finger did it without me meaning to." That would draw attention to the thing if Strike hadn't thought anything of it. As she closed her laptop, her mobile screen lit up. She'd received a long, excited text from her mother about baby Annabelle Marie's perfection, complete with a photograph of herself cradling her new granddaughter. Robin's father beaming over his wife's shoulder. Robin texted back, "She's gorgeous." Even though the baby was quite as unprepossessing in the new photograph as she'd been in the old. Yet she wasn't really lying. The fact of Annabelle's birth was somehow gorgeous, an everyday miracle, and Robin's mysterious shower tears had been partly in acknowledgement of the fact. As the tube sped her towards Piccadilly Circus, Robin took out her copy of C.B. Oakton's book, which she'd found at a second-hand bookshop in Chester, and flicked through it again. The dealer had said the book had been in his shop for several years and had arrived in a job lot of books he'd taken off the hands of a family of an elderly local woman who'd died. Robin suspected that the dealer hadn't known of the book's murky legal status before Robin's email inquiry, but he appeared to have no particular moral qualms about selling it. As long as Robin guaranteed by phone that she wouldn't reveal where she'd got it, he was happy to part with it for a hefty markup. Robin only hoped Strike would think the price justified once he'd read it. Robin's particular copy appeared to have escaped pulping because it had been one of the author's free copies, which must have been given to him before the court decision. An inscription on the flyleaf read, "To Auntie May, with every good wish, C.B. Oakden, brackets, Carl." To Robin, "with every good wish" seemed an affected, grandiose message to send an aunt. Barely 100 pages long, the flimsy paperback had a photograph of Margot as a bunny girl on the cover, a picture familiar to Robin because it had appeared in so many newspaper reports of her disappearance. Half cut off in this enlarged picture was a second bunny girl, who Robin knew to be Una Kennedy. The photograph was reproduced in its entirety in the middle of the paperback, along with other pictures which Robin thought Strike would agree were the most valuable part of the book, though only, she feared, in terms of putting faces to names rather than helping the investigation. Robin got off the tube at Piccadilly Circus and walked in a strong wind up Piccadilly, beneath swaying Christmas lights, wondering where she might find a baby present for Stephen and Jenny. Having passed no appropriate shops, she arrived outside Fortnum and Mason with an hour to spare before the projected meeting with Una Kennedy. Robin had often passed the famous store since she had lived in London, but never gone inside. The ornate frontage was duck-egg blue, and the windows, dressed for Christmas, some of the most beautiful in the city. Robin peered through clear circles of glass, surrounded by artificial snow, at heaps of jewel-like crystallized fruits, silk scarves, gilded tea canisters, and wooden nutcrackers shaped like fairy-tale princes. A gust of particularly cold, rain-flecked wind whipped at her, and without conscious thought, Robin allowed herself to be swept inside the sumptuous seasonal fantasy through a door flanked by a doorman in an overcoat and top hat. The store was carpeted in scarlet. Everywhere were mountains of duck-egg blue packaging. Close at hand, she saw the very truffles that Morris had bought her for her birthday. Past marzipan fruits and biscuits she walked, until she glimpsed the cafe at the back of the ground floor, where they'd agreed to meet Una. Robin turned back. She didn't want to see the retired vicar before the allotted time, because she wanted to reason herself into a more business-like frame of mind before an interview.
"Excuse me," she asked a harried-looking woman, selecting marzipan fruits for a client. "Do you sell anything for children in third floor?"
said the woman, already moving away. The small selection of children's goods available were, in Robin's view, exorbitantly priced. But as Annabel's only aunt and only London-based relative, she felt a certain pressure to give a suitably metropolitan gift. Accordingly, she purchased a large, cuddly Paddington bear. Robin was walking away from the till with her duck-egg carrier bag when her mobile rang. Expecting it to be Strike, she saw instead an unknown number.
"Hi, Robin here."
"Hi, Robin, it's Tom," said an angry voice. Robin couldn't for the life of her think who Tom was. She mentally ran through the cases the agency was currently working on, Two Times, Twinkle Toes, Postcard, Shifty, and Bamborough, trying in vain to remember a Tom, while saying with what she intended to be, "Yes, of course, I know who you are," warmth.
"Oh, hi."
"Tom Turvey," said the man, who didn't appear fooled.
"Oh,"
said Robin, her heart beginning to beat uncomfortably fast, and she drew back into an alcove where pricey-scented candles stood on shelves. Tom Turvey was Sarah Shadlock's fiancé. Robin had had no contact with him since finding out that their respective partners had been sleeping together. She'd never particularly liked him, nor had she ever found out whether he knew about the affair.
"Thanks," said Tom. "Thanks a fucking bunch, Robin."
He was close to shouting. Robin distanced the mobile a little from her ear.
"Excuse me," she said.
But she suddenly seemed to have become all nerves and pulse.
"Didn't bother fucking telling me, eh? Just walked away and washed your hands, did you? Tom, she's told me fucking everything. And you knew a year ago, and I find out today, 4 weeks before my wedding. Tom, I hope you're fucking happy,"
he bellowed. Robin removed the phone from her ear and held it at arm's length. He was still clearly audible as he yelled,
"I'm the only one of us who hasn't been fucking around, and I'm the one who's been fucked over!"
Robin cut him off. Her hands were shaking.
"Excuse me,"
said a large woman, who was trying to see the candles on the shelves behind Robin,
who mumbled an apology and walked away until she reached a curving iron banister, beyond which was a large, circular expanse of thin air. Looking down, she saw the floors had been cut out so that she was able to see right into the basement, where compressed people were crisscrossing the space with baskets laden with expensive hams and bottles of wine. Head spinning, hardly aware of what she was doing, Robin turned and headed blindly back toward the department exit, trying not to bump into tables piled with fragile china. Down the red-carpeted stairs she walked, trying to breathe herself back to calm, trying to make sense of what she'd just heard.
"Robin?"
She walked on, and only when somebody said, "Robin!" again, did she turn and realize Strike had just entered the store via a side door from Duke Street. The shoulders of his overcoat were studded with glimmering raindrops.
"Hi," she said, dazed.
"You all right?"
For a split second, she wanted to tell him everything. After all, he knew about Matthew's affair. He knew how her marriage had ended, and he'd met Tom and Sarah. However, Strike himself looked tense, his mobile gripped in his hand.
"Fine. You?"
"Not great," he said.
The two of them moved aside to allow a group of tourists into the store. In the shadow of the wooden staircase, Strike said,
"Joan's taken a turn for the worse. They've readmitted her to hospital."
"Oh, God, I'm so sorry," said Robin. "Listen, go to Cornwall. We'll cope. I'll interview Una. I'll take care of everything."
"No. She specifically told Ted she didn't want us all dashing down there again. But that's not like her."
Strike seemed every bit as scattered and distracted as Robin felt, but now she pulled herself together. Screw Tom, screw Matthew and Sarah.
"Seriously, Cormoran, go. I can take care of work."
"They're expecting me in a fortnight for Christmas. Ted says she's desperate to have us all at home. It's supposed to be just for a couple of days, the hospital thing."
"Well, if you're sure," said Robin.
She checked her watch. "We've got 10 minutes until Una's supposed to be here. Want to go to the cafe and wait for her?"
"Yeah," said Strike. "Good thinking. I could use a coffee."
"God rest ye merry gentlemen," trilled from the speakers as they entered the realm of crystallized fruits and expensive teas, both lost in painful thought. Chapter 24. My delight is all in joyfulness, in beds, in bowers, in banquets, and in feasts, and ill becomes you with your lofty creasts to scorn the joy that Jove is glad to seek. Edmund Spenser, The Faerie Queen. The cafe was reached by a flight of stairs that placed it on a higher level than the shop floor, which it overlooked. Once he and Robin had sat down at a table for four by the window, Strike sat silently looking down into Jermyn Street, where passers-by were reduced to moving mushrooms, eclipsed by their umbrellas. He was a stone's throw from the restaurant in which he'd last seen Charlotte. He'd received several more calls from her since the nude photograph on his birthday, plus several texts, three of which had arrived the previous evening. He'd ignored all of them, but somewhere at the back of his anxiety about Joan scuttled a familiar worry about what Charlotte's next move was going to be, because the texts were becoming increasingly overwrought. She had a couple of suicide attempts in her past, one of which had almost succeeded. 3 years after he'd left her, she was still trying to make him responsible for her safety and her happiness, and Strike found it equally infuriating and saddening. When Ted had called Strike that morning with the news about Joan, the detective had been in the process of looking up the telephone number of the merchant bank where Charlotte's husband worked. If Charlotte threatened suicide or sent any kind of final message, Strike intended to call Jago.
"Cormoran,"
Robin said. He looked round. A waiter had arrived at the table. When both had ordered coffee and Robin some toast, each relapsed into silence. Robin was looking away from the window towards the shoppers, stocking up on fancy groceries for Christmas, down on the shop floor, and rerunning Tom Turvey's outburst in her head. The aftershocks were still hitting her. 4 weeks before my fucking wedding. It must have been called off. Sarah had left Tom for Matthew, the man she'd wanted all along, and Robin was sure she wouldn't have left Tom unless Matthew had shown himself ready to offer her what Tom had, diamonds and a change of name.
I'm the only one of us who hasn't been fucking around.
Everyone had been unfaithful, in Tom's opinion, except poor Tom. So Matthew must have told his old friend that she, Robin, had been sleeping with someone else, which meant Strike, of course, of whom Matthew had been perennially jealous and suspicious from the moment Robin had gone to work for him. And even now that Tom knew about Matthew and Sarah, after his old friend's duplicity and treachery had been revealed, Tom still believed the lie about Robin and Strike. Doubtless he thought his current misery was all Robin's fault, that if she hadn't succumbed to Strike, the domino effect of infidelity would never have been started.
You sure you're all right?
Robin started and looked around. Strike had come out of his own reverie and was looking at her over his coffee cup.
Fine, she said. Just knackered. Did you get my email?
Email? Said Strike, reaching for the phone in his pocket.
Yeah, but I haven't read it yet, sorry. Dealing with other...
Don't bother now, said Robin hastily, inwardly cringing at the thought of that accidental kiss, even in the midst of her new troubles. It isn't particularly important. It'll keep. I did find this, though. She took the copy of Whatever Happened to Margot Bamborough out of her bag and passed it over the table. But before Strike could express his surprise, she muttered, Give it back. Give it back now. Tugged it back out of his hand and stuffed it into her bag. A stout woman was heading towards them across the cafe. Two bulging bags of Christmas fare were dangling from her hands. She had the full cheeks and large square front teeth of a cheerful-looking chipmunk, an aspect that in her youthful photos had added a certain cheeky charm to her prettiness. The hair that had once been long, dark and glossy was now chin-length and white, except at the front, where a dashing bright purple streak had been added. A large silver and amethyst cross bounced on her purple sweater.
Una, said Robin.
That's me, she panted. She seemed nervous. The queues, well, what do I expect? Fortnum's at Christmas. But fair play, they do a lovely mustard.
Robin smiled. Strike drew out the chair beside him.
Thanks very much, said Una, sitting down.
Her Irish accent was attractive and barely eroded by what Robin knew had been a longer residence in England than in the country of her birth. Both detectives introduced themselves.
Very nice to meet you, Una said,
shaking hands before clearing her throat nervously.
Excuse me, I was made up to get your message, she told Strike. Years and years I spent wondering why Roy never hired someone, because he got the money to do it, and the police never got anywhere. So little Anna called you in, did she? God bless that girl. What she must have gone through. Oh, hello, she said to the waiter. Could I have a cappuccino and a bit of that carrot cake? Thank you.
When the waiter had gone, Una took a deep breath and said,
I know I'm rattling on. I'm nervous, that's the truth.
There is nothing to be, began Strike.
Oh, yes, there is,
Una contradicted him, looking sober.
Whatever happened to Margot, it can't be anything good, can it? Nigh on 40 years I've prayed for that girl, prayed for the truth, and prayed God would look after her, alive or dead. She was the best friend I ever had, and... Sorry, I knew this would happen. Knew it.
She picked up her unused cloth napkin and mopped her eyes.
Ask me a question, she said, half laughing. Save me from myself.
Robin glanced at Strike, who handed the interview to her with a look as he pulled out his notebook.
Well, perhaps we can start with how you and Margot met, Robin suggested. We can, of course, said Una. That would have been 66. We were both auditioning to be bunny girls. You'll know all about that.
Robin nodded.
I had a decent figure then, believe it or not, said Una,
smiling as she gestured down at her tubby torso, although she seemed to feel little regret for the loss of her waist. Robin hoped Strike wasn't going to take her to task later for not organizing her questions according to the usual categories of people, places, and things. But she judged it better to make this feel more like a normal conversation, at least at first, because Una was still visibly nervous.
"Did you come over from Ireland to try and get the job?" asked Robin.
"Oh, no," said Una. "I was already in London. I kind of run away from home, truth be told. You're looking at a convent girl with a mammy as strict as a prison warder. I had a week's wages from a clothes shop in Derry in me pocket, and me mammy gave me one row too many. I walked out, got on the ferry, came to London and sent a postcard home to tell him I was alive and not to worry. My mammy didn't speak to me for 30 years. I was waitressing when I heard they were opening a Playboy club in Mayfair. Well, the money was crazy good compared to what you could earn in a normal place. £35 a week we started on. That's near enough 600 a week nowadays. There was nowhere else in London was going to pay a working-class girl that. It was more than most of our daddies earned.
And you met Margot at the club?
I met her at the audition. Knew she'd get hired the moment I looked at her. She had the figure of a model, all legs, and the girl lived on sugar. She was 3 years younger than me, and she lied about her age, so they'd take. "Oh, thank you very much," said Una,
as the waiter placed her cappuccino and carrot cake in front of her.
"Why was Margot auditioning?"
Robin asked.
"Because her family had nothing, and I mean nothing now," Una said. "Her daddy had an accident when she was 4, fell off a stepladder, broke his back, crippled. That's why she had no brothers and sisters. Her mammy used to clean people's houses. My family had more than the Bamboroughs, and nobody ever got rich farming a place the size of ours. But the Bamboroughs were not enough to eat poor. She was such a clever girl, but the family needed help. She got herself into medical school, told the university she'd have to defer for a year, then headed straight for the Playboy Club. We took to each other straight away in the audition, because she was so funny."
"Was she?" said Robin. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw Strike look up from his notebook in surprise.
"Oh, Margot Bamborough was the funniest person I ever knew in my life," said Una. "In my life, now. We used to laugh till we cried. I've never laughed like that since. Proper Cockney accent, and she could just make you laugh until you dropped. So we started work together. And they were strict, mind you," said Una, now forking cake into her mouth as she talked. "Inspected you before you walked out on the floor. Uniform on properly, nails done, and then there were rules like you've no idea. They used to put plainclothes detectives in the club to catch us out, make sure we weren't giving out our full names or our phone numbers. If you were any good at it, you could put a tidy bit of money away. Margot graduated to cigarette girl, selling them out of a little tray. She was popular with the men because she was so funny. She hardly spent a penny on herself. She split a lot between a savings account for medical school and the rest she gave her mammy. Worked every hour they'd let her. Bunny Peggy, she called herself, because she didn't want any of the punters to know her real name. I was Bunny Una, because nobody knew how to say Una. We got all kinds of offers. You had to say no, of course. But it was nice to be asked, right enough," said Una. And perhaps picking up on Robin's surprise, she smiled and said, "Don't think Margot and I didn't know exactly what we were doing, corseted up with bunny ears on our heads. What you maybe don't realise is a woman couldn't get a mortgage in those days without a man co-signing the forms. Same with credit cards. I squandered my money at first, but I learned better, learned from Margot. I got smart. I started saving. I ended up buying me own flat with cash. Middle-class girls, with their mammies and daddies paying their way, they could afford to burn their bras and have hairy armpits. Margot and I, we did what we had to. Anyway, the Playboy Club was sophisticated. It wasn't a knocking shop. It had licenses it would have lost if things got seedy. We had women guests, too. Men used to bring their wives, their dates. The worst we had was a bit of tail-pulling. But if a club member got really handsy, he lost his membership. You should have seen what I had to put up with in my job before that. Hands up me skirt when I bent over a table, and worse. They looked after us at the Playboy Club. Members weren't allowed to date bunny girls. Well, in theory. It happened. It happened to Margot. I was angry at her for that, I said. You're risking everything, you fool.
Was this Paul Satchwell? Asked Robin.
It was indeed, said Una. He'd come to the club as someone's guest. He wasn't a member, so Margot thought it was a grey area. I was still worried she was going to lose the job.
You didn't like him?
No, I didn't like him, said Una. Thought he was Robert Plant, so he did. But Margot fell for him, hook, line and sinker. She didn't go out a lot, see, because she was saving. I'd been round the nightclubs in me first year in London. I'd met plenty of Satchwells. He was 6 years older than she was, an artist, and he wore his jeans so tight you could see his cock and balls right through them. Strike let out an involuntary snort of laughter. Una looked at him.
Sorry, he muttered. You're not like most vicars I've met.
Oh, I don't think the good Lord will mind me mentioning cocks and balls, said Una airily. He made 'em, didn't he?
So they started dating? Asked Robin.
They did, said Una. Mad passion it was. You could feel the heat off the two of them. For Margot, see, before Satchwell, she'd always had tunnel vision about life, you know, eyes on the prize. Become a doctor and save her family. She was cleverer than any of the boys she knew, and men don't like that much nowadays. She was taller than half of them as well. She told me she'd never had a man interested in her brains before Satchwell. Interested in her brains, my Aunt Nelly. The girl had a body like Jane Birkin. Oh, and it wasn't only his looks either, she said. He'd read things. He could talk about art. He could talk for the hour about art right enough. I heard him. Well, I don't know a Monet from a poster of Margate, so I'm no judge, but it sounded a load of old bollocks to me. But he'd take Margot out to a gallery and educate her about art. Then he'd take her home to bed. Sex makes fools of us all, sighed Una Kennedy. And he was her very first, and it was obvious, you know, she nodded at Robin. He knew what he was doing, so it was all that much more important to her. Mad in love she was, mad. Then, one night, just a couple of weeks before she was supposed to be starting medical school, she turns up at my flat howling. She dropped in on Paul unexpected after work, and there was another woman at the flat with him, naked. Madeline, he told her. Madeline, at midnight. She turned round and ran. He went chasing after her, but she jumped in a taxi and came to mine. Heartbroken she was. All night we sat up talking, me saying, you're better off without him, which was no more than the truth. I said to her, Margot, you're about to start medical school. The place'll be wall to wall with handsome, clever boys training to be doctors. You won't remember Satchwell's name after a week or two. But then, near dawn, she told me a thing I've never told anyone before. Una hesitated. Robin tried to look politely but warmly receptive. She'd let him take pictures of her. You know, pictures. And she was scared. She wanted them back. I said to her, why in God's name would you let him do such a thing, Margot? Because it would have killed her mother. The pride they had in her, their only daughter, their brilliant girl. If those photos turned up anywhere, a magazine or I don't know what, they'd have never lived it down, boasting up and down their street about their Margot the genius. So I said, I'll come with you and we'll get him back. So, we went round there early and banged on his door. The bastard, excuse me now, she said. You'll rightly say that's not a Christian attitude, but wait till you hear. Satchwell said to Margot, I'll speak to you, but not your nanny.
Your nanny?
Well now, I spent 10 years working with domestic abuse survivors in Wolverhampton, and it's one of the hallmarks of an abuser. If their victim isn't compliant, it's because she's under someone else's control. Her nanny. Before I know what's going on, she's inside and I'm stuck on the other side of the closed door. He'd pulled her in and slammed it in my face. I could hear them shouting at each other. Margot was given as good as she got, God bless her. And then, and this is what I really wanted to tell you, said Una, and I want to get it right. I told that Inspector Talbot, and he didn't listen to a word I was saying, and I told the one who took over, what was his name? Lawson? Asked Robin. Lawson, said Una, nodding. I told both of them. I could hear Margot and Paul screaming at each other through the door. Margot telling him to give her the pictures and the negatives. Different world, you see. Negatives you had to get if he didn't want more copies made. But he refused. He said they were his copyright, the dirty bastard. So then I heard Margot say, and this is the important bit, if you show those pictures to anyone, if they ever turn up in print, I'll go straight to the police and I'll tell them all about your little pillow dream.
Pillow dream? Repeated Robin. That's what she said. And he hit her. A smack loud enough to hear through solid wood, and I heard her shriek. Well, I started hammering and kicking the door. I said, unless he opened it, I was going for the police right now. That put the fear of God into him. He opened the door, and Margot comes out, hand to her face. It was bright red. You could see his finger marks. And I pulled her behind me, and I said to Satchwell, don't you ever come near her again. And you heard what she said. There'll be trouble if those pictures turn up anywhere. And I swear to you, he looked murderous. He stepped right up to me, the way a man will when he wants to remind you what he could do if he wanted. Almost standing on my toes he was. I didn't shift, said Una Kennedy. I stood my ground, but I was scared, I won't deny it. And he said to Margot, have you told her? And Margot says, she doesn't know anything. Yet. And he says, well, you know what'll happen if I find out you've talked. And he mimed, well, never mind. It was an obscene pose, I suppose you'd say, one of the pictures he'd taken. And he walked back into his flat and slammed the door. Did Margot ever tell you what she meant by the pillow dream? Asked Robin. She wouldn't. You might think she was scared, but, you know, I think it's just women, sighed Una. We're socialized that way, but maybe Mother Nature's got a hand in it. How many kids would survive to their first birthday if their mammies couldn't forgive them? Even that day, with his handprint across her face, she didn't want to tell me, because there was a bit of her that didn't want to hurt him. I saw it all the bloody time with my domestic abuse survivors. Women still protecting them, still worrying about them. Love dies hard in some women. Did she see Satchwell after that? I wish to God I could say she didn't, said Una, shaking her head. But yes, she did. They couldn't stay away from each other. She started her degree course, but she was that popular at the club, they let her go part-time, so I was still seeing a lot of her. One day, her mammy called the club because her daddy had taken sick, but Margot hadn't come in. I was terrified. Where was Margot? What had happened to her? Why wasn't she there? I've often thought back to that moment, you know, because when it happened for real, I was so sure at first she'd turn up, like she had the first time. Anyway, when she saw how upset I'd been, thinking she'd gone missing, she told me the truth. She and Satchwell had started things up again. She had all the old excuses down. He swore he'd never hit her again. He cried his eyes out about it. It was the worst mistake of his life, and anyway, she'd provoked him. I told her, if you can't see him now for what he is, after what he did to you first time round. Anyway, they split up again, and surprise, surprise, he not only knocked her around again, he kept her locked in his flat all day so she couldn't get to work. That was the first shift she'd ever missed. She nearly lost the job over it, and had to make up some cock and bull story. So then, at last, said Una, she tells me she's learned her lesson. I was right all along. She's never going back to him, that's it. Finito. Did she get the photographs back? Asked Robin. First thing I asked when I found out they were back together. She said he told her he'd destroyed them. She believed it too. You didn't. Of course I didn't, said Una. I'd seen him when she threatened him with this pillow dream. That was a frightened man. He'd never have destroyed anything that gave him bargaining power over her. Would it be all right if I get another cappuccino? Asked Una apologetically. My throat's dry. All this talking. Of course, said Strike, hailing a waiter and ordering fresh coffees all round. Una pointed at Robin's Fortnum's bag. Been stocking up for Christmas too? Oh, no. I've been buying a present for my new niece. She was born this morning, said Robin, smiling.
Congratulations, said Strike,
who was surprised Robin hadn't already told him.
Oh, how lovely, said Una. My fifth grandchild arrived last month.
The interval while waiting for the fresh coffees was filled by Una showing Robin pictures of her grandchildren, and Robin showing Una the two pictures she had of Annabelle Marie.
"Gorgeous, isn't she?"
said Una, peering through her purple reading glasses at the picture on Robin's phone. She included Strike in the question, but seeing only an angry-looking bald monkey, his acquiescence was half-hearted. When the coffees had arrived and the waiter moved away again, Robin said,
"While I remember, would you happen to know if Margot had family or friends in Leamington Spa?"
"Leamington Spa?"
repeated Una, frowning.
"Let's see. One of the girls at the club was from... No, that was King's Lynn. They're similar sorts of names, aren't they? I can't remember anyone from there, no. Why? We've heard a man claim to have seen her there a week after she disappeared. There were a few sightings after, right enough. Nothing in any of them. None of them made sense. Leamington Spa, that's a new one."
She took a sip of her cappuccino. Robin asked, "Did you still see a lot of each other once Margot went off to medical school?"
"Oh, yeah, because she was still working at the club part-time. How she did it all, studying, working, supporting her family, living on nerves and chocolate, skinny as ever. And then, at the start of her second year, she met Roy."
Una sighed.
"Even the cleverest people can be bloody stupid when it comes to their love lives," she said. "In fact, I sometimes think the cleverer they are with books, the stupider they are with sex. Margot thought she'd learned her lesson, that she'd grown up. She couldn't see that it was classic reboned. He might have looked as different from Satchwell as you could get, but really, it was more of the same. Roy had the kind of background Margot would have loved. Books, travel, culture, you know. See, there were gaps in what Margot knew. She was insecure about not knowing about the right fork, the right words, napkin instead of serviette, all that snobby English stuff. Roy was mad for her, mind you. It wasn't all one way. I could see what the appeal was. She was like nothing he'd ever known before. She shocked him, but she fascinated him. The Playboy Club and her work ethic, her feminist ideas, supporting her mammy and daddy. They had arguments, intellectual arguments, you know. But there was something bloodless about the man. Not wet exactly, but..."
Una gave a sudden laugh.
"Bloodless. You'll know about his bleeding problem."
"Yes," said Robin. "Von something disease."
"That's the one," said Una. "He'd been cosseted and wrapped up in cottonwool all his life by his mother, who was a horror. I met her a few times. That woman gave me the respect you'd give something you'd got stuck on your shoe. And Roy was... still waters run deep, I suppose, sums it up. He didn't show a lot of emotion. Their flirtation wasn't all sex. It really was ideas with them. Not that he wasn't good-looking. He was handsome in a kind of limp way. As different from Satchwell as you could imagine. Pretty boy, all eyes and floppy hair. But he was a manipulator. A little bit of disapproval here, a cold look there. He loved how different Margot was, but it still made him uncomfortable. He wanted a woman the exact opposite to his mother, but he wanted Mammy to approve. So the fault lines were there from the beginning." "And he could sulk," said Una. "I hate a sulker now. My mother was the same. 30 years she wouldn't talk to me because I moved to London. She finally gave in so she could meet her grandchildren. But then my sister got tipsy at Christmas and let it slip I'd left the church and joined the Anglicans. We were finished forever. Playboy, she could forgive. Proddy, never. Even when they were dating, Roy would stop talking to Margot for days at a time. She told me once he cut her off for a week. She lost patience. She said, 'I'm off.' That brought him round sharp enough. I said, 'What was he sulking about?' And it was the club. He hated her working there. I said, 'Is he offering to support your family while you study?' 'Oh, he doesn't like the idea of other men ogling me,' she says. Girls like that idea, that little bit of possessiveness. They think it means he only wants her, when of course it's the other way round. He only wants her available to him. He's still free to look at other girls, and Roy had other people.